Well, first of all, what a great crowd. Lovely to see so many faces, and in some cases, remember the names that go with the faces. I'm still working on some. I'm not going to introduce the three panelists at length, given our time constraints here, and also because they all have such long records of accomplishment that I might eat up way too much of the time. I also suspect that all three of them are probably very well known to all of you. I will just say that Thomas Junot, Stephanie Beck, and Jonathan Berkshire Miller are three of the most experienced and informed and insightful experts on Canadian security and foreign policy in Canada today. And we are very fortunate to have all three of them here at the same time. Just as we are also very fortunate to have Carrie Buck, our former ambassador to NATO, who is serving as the rapporteur for this session and the others later on this afternoon. So, if you want to sneak anything into the minutes or anything, you can go and accost her later. I'm struck that this is a really topical session we're about to have. Probably a lot of Globe and Mail readers in this room. I picked up the Globe and Mail this morning, and there were two stories on the front page. One of them pointing out that the Secretary of State for Crime was attributing the recent shootings in Toronto to a foreign entity, which certainly struck to the heart of the question of Canadian security. And the second one was one that said that it may be impossible for reasons of an inadequate workforce to have a new submarine maintenance facility built and maintained in Atlantic Canada at the same time as we're trying to build new frigates. So I think there isn't a day that goes by now when you can't flip through the newspaper and be accosted by issues related to Canadian security. The panel, as Michael just reminded us, I mean, the day here is all about realities and illusions of Canadian foreign policy, which is an extremely broad topic. The panel is targeted a little bit more precisely on realities and illusions of Canadian security, but that still leaves us with a very big sandbox in which to play. Canadian security encompasses a lot. We could focus on a great many different dimensions of the topic, some of them urgent, some of them complex, some of them ignored, and many of them overlapping. And within that range of topics, there's a great deal of diversity. We could look at economic security, we could look at military preparedness, we could look at domestic security, we could look at intelligence challenges, we could look at foreign interference or technological evolution, or legal frameworks, or cyberspace vulnerability, or outer space competition, or many other aspects of what, frankly, is a daunting and overloaded national security agenda. And I hope that we will be able, over the course of the next hour here, to delve into a couple of those more specific issues and others that may be raised from the floor. But to start, I would like to give all three of these panelists free rein to choose and focus on any aspect of the Canadian security agenda for which you feel that the juxtaposition of current illusions and realities is the most illustrative. So I will start with Thomas and then move to Stephanie and then go on to Jonathan. Thomas, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. So I figured that I would start at a fairly broad level, and I think after that, in next questions and maybe in Q&A, we can zoom in on more specific angles. And the one general question that I would focus on in terms of lots of illusions and realities is multilateralism, more or less in the security realm, but I think some of what I'll be saying applies also beyond security. So the point I want to I want to make is that increasingly we see traditional forms of multilateralism being replaced by more ad hoc, smaller formats, looser formats. We can use different names, but one way to think about that is to call it mini-lateralism. This is a trend that I think we should expect to continue. It's a trend that we see now with President Trump. It's a trend that predates Trump. It is a format of international cooperation that clearly President Biden favored that went back before that. So the question is, how does it work? What does it actually mean? And how can Canada leverage it? The basic rule of mini-lateralism is that you have to pay to play. You pay less, and if you pay more, then you play more and you benefit more, right? It works as an investment. I think we all understand that multilateralism has always worked like that, at least to some extent. But what is changing really in recent years is the, if you want to frame it in terms of investments, is the investment return ratio. In the past, a country like Canada could pay less and still try to play at least to some extent, show up, be invited at a range of multilateral settings, a range of tables, as we could say. But now what is changing is that if you don't pay more, you will simply not be invited to play anymore, certainly not at the extent to the extent you were before. So the return ratio is really changing. This has two important sets of implications for us here, one on resources and one on priorities. The first one is pretty obvious. You need something to pay. You need a currency to put on the table. Whether it's diplomatic, whether it's military, whether it's intelligence, right? If we want to stay in the realm of security today, intelligence diplomacy has always been very transactional, but I think we can expect it to be even more transactional in the future, where if you want to get something in return, you need to give. It has always been like that, but if I go back to my point about investment returns, the beauty of the Five Eyes for us, which is a very typical example of mini-lateralism, ad hoc, loose, very informal, no permanent secretariat, within the Five Eyes, we paid, right? We put something on the table at the Five Eyes, but we get much more than we pay. And I think current trends suggest that we can expect in the future, not only within the Five Eyes, but in other, for example, direct fora in which we cooperate directly with the United States in the intelligence field, that we can expect that return ratio to be less than in the past. We will continue to pay, we will continue to give, but we will get less. So the first point is resources, right? You need more resources if you want to be able to benefit from mini-lateralism. The first one, the second implication is priorities. There is a proliferation of mini-lateral fora. There is no realistic world in which Canada can be involved in each of them. Whereas in the past, speaking about illusions to some extent, we clearly had a tradition of simply wanting to be involved in as many multilateral, in the traditional sense, fora as we could, even if in practice we had little to put on the table. There was this tradition of sprinkling across multiple fora. That is increasingly difficult to do, which raises the issue of being much more selective, much more strategic in terms of which fora do we choose. So this is an exercise in priority setting that traditionally we have been able to neglect, not to say that we didn't do it. Of course, we set priorities, but far less, I think, than we will need to in the future. We were able to basically fudge it by being less selective or less focused on priorities. It will be much more costlier in the future in this new dynamic. And I'll stop here to be brief.
Thank you. Daphne?
Oui. Bonjour tout le monde. Ça fait plaisir d'être là et voir tout le monde en personne. Ça fait longtemps pour certains d'entre vous. And sorry for you guys on TV, we can't see you here. So I'm sure y'all look great. Younger than all of us in the room, for sure. Thank you for the invitation, and weird to be called an expert. I don't know about you, but I've never felt like an expert, even after 36 years of one job or another. I counted, actually, I've done 22 different jobs, so I'm really good about 3 inches deep, okay, on pretty much everything. Moi, j'avais demandé de parler sur les préparations des militaires pour la défense du Canada. And I think what's important is to go back to why are we defending Canada? What is it that we are defending? Really the very basics. And that frankly changes depending on what's going on geopolitically, what's happening with climate, what's happening with migration, what's happening with water levels. Depends where you look to figure out what it is that we're after. In the last round of conversations within national defense, our concern was really much more about what you cannot see. In fact, we're already in a cyber war, as many of you will already know from your own personal experiences or businesses that you work with. And the military is, of course, responsible for, if you think of it more as the physical defense of Canada, from seabed to space. And there as well, huge changes with the arrival of new technology and staying on top of what the future of war will look like is perhaps the most difficult part of the organization's thinking and the preparations, not only of the CAF, the Canadian Armed Forces, but also of the defense industry in Canada. And I can come back to the workforce question, which is, I think, really useful. So the need to stay ahead and aware of new technologies means that you can watch, for instance, what has been happening in Ukraine and the changes in warfare. Nobody thought we would be fighting a ground war in 2020s at any point in time. And indeed, these days, it's not so much a ground war as a not very high above the ground war with the drones, which have provided all kinds of opportunities that we would not even have conceived of as recently as 5-10 years ago. So the nature of war is changing, and then that means as well that what it is we need to defend Canada is also changing. Also, as I've said in other fora, that means that how you procure has to change. You're not just buying this widget that will last you for 10 years. You have to buy something that will be adjustable as new technology comes on board. So in the past, with very minimal funding, when poor Gord was trying to lead the organization, priority setting was critical. And that meant really defining it down to two or three challenges that the military was facing that they may be able to fund solutions for. We're not in that space anymore. And, you know, thanks to some of our neighbors and NATO allies for stepping up to the plate, but also reminding us all that the geopolitics has changed to the extent that we really need to invest. And indeed, this year, Canada did spend over 2% of GDP. The challenge, of course, is spending it in ways that Canadians will see a difference, that we will all feel an improved security and defense environment. And that's pretty tricky. In the end, the decision for the first round of specific amounts of funding was to invest in the basics, because if you don't have a strong foundation, the rest of it's kind of worthless. And that meant increasing the numbers of military in Canada. And I know we're well on track to exceeding for a second year in a row the numbers of recruits. But that also means going forward, going beyond the 82,000 that is currently planned to something well over 100. And if the Chief of Defense Forces has her way, a sort of parallel civil organization. Not really military civilians, though, that are well-trained and able to help. You will have seen, though, and here's where maybe the illusion is, if the illusion is that national defense is the only government department responsible for defending Canada, the reality is it's everybody. It's not just the whole of government, it's the whole of society. And that is very much reflective of the kinds of challenges that we're facing right now. And this is, in fact, partly where the initiative to have a broader civilian parallel structure, a force that could be called upon in times of emergencies. And these days, that really means natural disasters. So more folks trained and available to go in and assist, thereby leaving the CAF able to fight what I'll call a real war, as opposed to sandbagging when there's flooding. And I think we'll see more of that in the future. So the investments that are being made right now will result in a stronger military, more ready to fight, with higher readiness levels that are currently about 50% across the board on pretty much everything, as in 50% of the aircraft can fly on any given day, 50% of the ships can travel on any given day, a quarter of the submarines can do anything some of the days. forget the other three. And then going beyond that, a stronger Coast Guard, the integration of the Coast Guard, of course, into national defense last year, not militarizing it, but leveraging and finding more synergies in the work that we already do together, and more funding into CSE and CSIS and the RCMP. And that is a reflection, again, of the broader nature of security and defense and the challenges facing Canada that Gord was referring to right in the beginning. You could go even farther than that in the definition of security beyond economic prosperity, for instance, to include food security. So interesting to see the recent announcements on that as well, coming out of the Prime Minister's office and Agriculture Canada. And I'll stop here, but
if only we had a former Deputy Minister of Agriculture.
So I have views on that one too, but, you know, actually it's money very well spent. We could share seed conversations later.
Jonathan?
Well, thank you, Gord, and thank you to the organizers. We only have a few minutes to talk about the illusions of Canadian foreign policy and the realities. But it's a great topic for today. I've been on the road a lot the last 6 months, and I never thought I'd hear Davos in so many different capitals, you know, from Ulaanbaatar to Jakarta. So don't worry, I'm not going to give you a deciphering of the Davos speech. But I think I wanted to zoom in, Gord, first on the illusion of partnerships and what is a partner. Because I think right now with this surge to find partners, it's almost like you're at a dance party and you want everybody to be your dance partner. And I understand the tendency for it. I think it goes back, Thomas, to your point of multilateralism and wanting to be in every multilateral club. I think there is a surge right now in the thrust of diversification to also have every dance partner. And the challenge and the illusion on this is the false bifurcation that I say on security and economics. So, for example, when we talk about strategic partners and we talk about the feeling that we can separate security threats and defense threats from economic realities, I think we understand number one probably wasn't tenable 20 to 30 years ago, but absolutely is not tenable today. Our adversaries don't see the world that way, and I think we need to be really clear about that. So I think that's the first sort of point I would say is that, look, there's no neat and tidy way to separate things and say, well, we have our security side here, we have our economic trade side here, and we can have solid economic relationship, even deepening economic relationships, and not have that impact the security side. So I think that's the first thing when we define partners, that we realize that that is an interconnected space. The second one, and you know, I'm really happy Thomas mentioned this about pay to play when it's when talk about mini laterals or partnerships that are not necessarily traditional multilaterals, is that it's okay to think about these constructs, to think about whether it's trilaterals, quadrilaterals, pentagons, or bigger ones. But you actually have to bring something of value. And I'll give you an example, and some who may have recently worked in the department might have known of this example. But when we were crafting the Indo-Pacific strategy, I think one of the areas of affinity was our own quadrilateral. So the Canadian Quad, which would involve the United States, Japan, and Korea. I think where the conversation got a little complicated is to say, what do we actually want to do in that relationship? It's interesting to think about partners and think that naturally we share broad-based interests, rule of law, human rights, et cetera. But we actually have to provide something of value in these partnerships. And I think that is the biggest challenge when thinking about transcending some of the traditional alliances and thinking about many laterals, whether it's in Asia, whether it's beyond, is there are those specific things that I think Canada can provide value. So if you could go back in time, you know, get in your DeLorean and go back in time, I would say, for example, in this partnership, it probably would have been food security, actually would have been energy security. There's critical minerals, some of the areas that are very much in vogue now, but weren't necessarily premised in those partnerships at the time. So yes, think creatively, think about different vehicles of engagement, but do it with a very much solid focus on where is the added value. And the last sort of point I would mention too is that while things are interconnected thematically when it comes to the economic and security realm, I think it's helpful to remember, and increasingly this is so, it's true on the geographic forum as well. So I had a conversation earlier this morning with some German member of parliaments, and they were asking, is it going to be Europe or is it going to be Asia? Where is the Canadian government focused? And I said, it's both. It's absolutely interconnected. I mean, of course, you can just look at the battlefield in Ukraine and see how China is enabling that battlefield. And I think Kaja Kallas has been quite open about that recently. But look at the opposite side of this as well, of how Russia and China are collaborating in the Indo-Pacific, how Russia is enabling and continued proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in North Korea. I think we have to get it out of our head that we have one geographic sphere here, one geographic sphere here, and we can totally cut them up. And the last point, and I would say this is especially important for the Canadian audience, is the Arctic's a part of that too. So I think it's a unique responsibility for Canada. We're a three-ocean nation, and finally we're going to get those submarines, I hope soon. I guess that decision's coming next week. Is we have a vested interest in seeing those theaters as interconnected, transatlantic, Arctic, and Indo-Pacific. So I'll leave it there.
Well, you just gave me the perfect segue to the next question, so thank you very much. I wanted to stay with our illusions and realities theme. I'd like to ask each of you, and maybe I'll ask Stephanie to kick off this time, and then we'll go to Jonathan and come back to Tama. I'd like to ask each of you to talk a bit about the challenge presented by the type of distinct security challenges that Jonathan was just referring to, and their ability to complicate each other across geographic boundaries and sometimes in ways that we wouldn't really expect. You touched on it, Jonathan, but the war in Ukraine, for example, and the threats to the autonomy of Taiwan. If for no other reason than trying to support both of those parties is probably going to tax the resources of an awful lot of their friends. So it's clear, but you can draw, we could sit here and come up with a half a dozen examples in very short order of similar issues. Think of the crosswalk between efforts, multilateral efforts to try and arrest nuclear proliferation, and how they're complicated by efforts to try and revive progress in some kind of Middle East peace process, especially given that one of the countries that's critical to the Middle East peace process has never signed the NPT and has a nuclear weapon. And another one has signed the NPT and is working towards getting a nuclear weapon. So the crosswalks are everywhere. So I have to ask this. Is it possible that we are now living in a world in which every significant security challenge is directly or indirectly related to every other significant security challenge, to the point where we can't make progress resolving any one of them unless we can resolve all of them at the same time? Are we really living in a global village now that it is so small that it's all or nothing? Stephanie?
Boy, you're an uplifting guy to be on a panel with. But actually, I agree. It didn't take long before those watching the war in Ukraine to start to say China is part of this. And we cannot talk about this war and the ending of this war without a Chinese role. And even just from a strictly military tactical perspective, the Chinese are watching the same way everybody else is and saying, drones. What can you do long distance? But on the other hand, so are the Taiwanese. Don't have to be a really big country to be able to defend yourself relatively cheaply as well, or to make yourself into a porcupine, we like to say in Canada, to make yourself unattractive and difficult to invade. Or you can invade, but you can't hold. And I think that has been the big understanding that we have come to realize, all of us around the planet? And what does that imply then for how we arm ourselves or how we rearm? And what sort of ceasefire we might want, and how Russia might use a ceasefire like that? And who is helping whom, to your other question? And how come there are Iranian weapons landing in Ukraine being fired by Russians? So you see where the interconnectedness is. The other challenge that we have faced domestically, as indeed every country in Europe as well, is if we're sending all of our best weapons and best troops, in our case, to Latvia, and some in Germany and elsewhere, well, they're not here at home. So at what point do we decide there are too many abroad rather than at home? Canada has traditionally been, as everybody knows, a sender of expeditionary forces and not spending so much time on defending ourselves. I think that pendulum has changed. But that also means then, if we're buying weapons for our guys in Latvia, our troops in Latvia, are we buying the same ones for home? Do we need to, though? It's a very different theater here, or would be. The troops themselves have regularly explained publicly, this isn't a secret, that those in Latvia are very well equipped, whereas those here are not. And is that fair? And how can you train, for instance, on a new piece of equipment if it's promptly sent to Latvia and you don't have it here accessible for training? So there's all sorts of disparities like that. When the most current war broke out in the Middle East, the first thing I thought was, well, the weapons will all be shipped to Israel instead of to Ukraine. So is there a which war is more important kind of conversation going on? Which one has the most consequences? Which one is the most likely to end early? You may remember very early on in the war in Ukraine, there was lots of discussion about a really big push. If everybody, all the allies, contribute enormous amounts of weapons really early on, would that be able to cut off the aggression at the pass? It didn't come to that. Politically, it wasn't possible to gather so much momentum that that would happen. But you do wonder if that would have saved billions and billions of dollars. And I think that's the other dilemma. We're spending over 2% of Canada's GDP right now on defense. Should we be spending more on food security, on energy security, on healthcare, you name it? It's a big decision underway and will be every year going forward. Those submarines are not cheap.
Well, thank you for that. And I take your point about the fact that technological changes mean that some of these issues get linked in ways that you hadn't anticipated, including the way they telescope distance. But a year and a half ago, Jonathan and I were on a study tour in Taiwan. And at one point, we were standing on a small island that is Taiwanese, but is, what, 2 kilometers, Jonathan, off the Chinese mainland? And we could see the mainland, and we could see China building a runway out into the ocean on land that it was reclaiming. And as the runway got longer, the distance between the Taiwanese island and the mainland got shorter. And Mark Norman, the former commander of the Navy who was with us, looked at that for a while, and then he said, you know, at this stage, the invasion isn't so much as a naval issue as it is just an engineering problem. And if you can bridge that gap with, you know, short distance drones, it's even less of an issue. Jonathan, over to you.
Yeah, I think we're depressing our audience, but I will continue to depress you even more. I think let me focus a little bit, zoom in on Taiwan a bit. So I think one of the risks, and I guess this is another illusion, is underestimating contagion. So, you know, for example, let's think about Ukraine, Iran, Taiwan, words that you kind of see in the newspaper a lot. The conflict in Iran, I think, as Tama knows well, he studies it closer than I do, is not just about Iran. It's obviously spread into the region. The conflict in Ukraine is not just about Ukraine. Continues to spread further. The conflict, potential conflict over Taiwan, and even the exercises around Taiwan are not just about Taiwan. And this is something I, to zoom into Taiwan for a moment, that I constantly remind folks. Look, Yonaguni Island in Japan and the Okinawan archipelago is 50 nautical miles from Taiwan. The Filipino archipelago is right in the proximity, in the belly of the South China Sea, interconnected with Taiwan. So when military strategists talk about the first island chain, they do that. They flip the map upside down. They do that quite intentionally to show that it will not be easy to confine challenges. And the economic analysis of, we're all ripping our hair out now because of the Strait of Hormuz, is that a Taiwan Strait contingency could potentially be a 5 to 6-fold impact economically on supply chains. And this would affect food security, energy security, traditional security. So it will be a walk in the park, what we've just experienced recently, compared to a potential shutting down of the Taiwan Strait. Because again, understanding those supply chains will show that it's not just the Taiwan Strait, which is vitally important. It's the Strait of Malacca, and then, of course, moving in towards the Strait of Hormuz as well. So all of this is part of one interconnected supply chain. So I think that's the first point, is that, not to make it sound scarier, but something happening seriously over Taiwan, and if this involved kinetic action that involved the United States, is much bigger than Taiwan. And I think a lot of us know that, but I think it's important to factor that into our planning. And the sort of second point I would say, and last point for Canada, is that this is no 2003 Iraq war. This is no current conflict in Iran where we just say, look, I opt out. Sorry, you know, I disagree with the premise if the United States decides to get kinetically involved. This is, whatever we think of it, our chief ally, our only neighbor, if you discount Russia in the north, that will be involved with a peer-to-peer kinetic conflict with the second biggest economy in the world. In some form, we don't get opt out of that. We know how that actually plays itself out, whether it's sanctions, whether it's logistics, not to mention the, you know, 50,000 plus Canadian citizens in the region. It's a big deal. Sorry, I feel like I'm depressing people even more, but it's something we need to be planning for and thinking about.
You framed your question as of everything being connected to everything. For my Francophone friends in the room, some of you may remember Jean Dion from Le Devoir, mon journaliste préféré de tous les temps. Jean Dion disait « tout est dans tout », ce qui est probablement la plus grande parole philosophique de l'histoire. So, somewhat more seriously, because it is a very serious Jean Dion quote. Basically. And I think the challenge here to answer more substantively the question is that we too often fail in our response to understand the interconnectedness of a number of different threats. We tend to silo our responses to threats that are in practice interconnected, which limits our ability to respond, even if in a narrow sense, our siloed response to one threat may be appropriate. By failing to be better connected, it doesn't work as well. And one way to think about that is the range of hybrid threats that we face today. Hybrid threats being a bit of a catch-all term, which can mean a lot of different things to different people, but it's basically threats below the level of open warfare. If we try to come up with a simple answer, think about foreign interference, transnational repression, disinformation, and so on. In our responses, we tend to analyze these threats separately, even if we vaguely understand that, yes, they're part of a big basket called hybrid threats. When we analyze the threat and when we mount our responses, we tend to view our responses also in a siloed way. The way we frame the threat and the response mentally, but also the way that we organize them institutionally. There is a transnational repression team. There is a disinformation team or multiple disinformation teams in different departments. There is a counter foreign interference team and so on. And these different teams know that each other exists. They may talk to each other. They may cooperate, but they do not cooperate as much as they should, given the interconnectedness of the threat. If you think about these different threats from the bad guys' perspective, it's the same set of tools that they will selectively use in different contexts and different purposes to promote disinformation, to interfere in our elections, to repress Iranian-Canadian or Chinese-Canadian activists, and so on. So Bottom line, my answer is yes, but in terms of our response, we fail too much at that level because we are too siloed, not only mentally, but also institutionally.
Thanks. I also sometimes think that we live in a world where we think we necessarily have a choice, that if two of these issues start, overlapping and complicating our lives, that we'll actually have the option of deciding whether or not we want to actually play any kind of a role in it. I was in Charlottetown 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, when HMCS Charlottetown completed its transit of the Taiwan Strait. And I remember thinking at the time, well, if that had been the moment that blew everything up, we'd be involved. There wouldn't be any way around that. The ship would have been in the middle of it. So it's sometimes I think we have the sense that we have the luxury of being able to pick and choose where we're going to be, and maybe we don't. So I want to move on to another question. I referred at the outset here to the Globe and Mail front page this morning and the comments from the Secretary of State for Crime about the shootings in Toronto. And that's maybe a good way to get into this. But I wanted to just focus a little bit now, staying with linkages, but in this case, the linkage between our domestic security issues and our international security problems. So, there are obvious ones here. If you're dealing with issues of foreign interference, it's pretty straightforward, right? If you accuse a foreign state of ordering the murder of people on your soil, and you don't anticipate that you're going to get a blowback from that foreign state, then you didn't really think it through before you you went down that road. If you arrest a senior official from a powerful country while they're transiting through your country, that's likely to have some consular problems that will arise from it. If you list part of a foreign state's government as an international terrorist organization, and then pass legislation which compromises the diplomatic immunity of that state, you're going to have a big problem. You may be trying to address a domestic security concern, but it's going to have international complications. If you impose financial sanctions, perhaps with the very legitimate goal of targeting money laundering, but in the process you end up sweeping up senior officials of foreign governments, then you may find it very difficult to have conversations with those governments going forward. I could go on with other completely hypothetical examples, but I will just note that obviously there are going to be challenges. And as I referred to earlier, acts of anti-Semitism or Islamophobia may be inspired by circumstances in the country, but they may also be in reaction to events that are taking place far from our shores. Or for that matter, there are a variety of very divisive domestic issues in other countries that are fought out inside diaspora groups inside the country. And I just note that the parts of our administration which are responsible for responding to these groups are very different. So if you're worried about the domestic security dimensions of this, you throw the RCMP into the problem, and you throw CSIS, and you throw FinTrack, and you throw in the Canadian Border Services Agency, and maybe you have to throw in the Coast Guard, and there are others. But if you're dealing with the foreign dimension of it, you have to throw in the people who are worrying about promoting Canadian values, protecting Canadian interests abroad. You have to worry about the role being played by diplomats and trade commissioners and development officers and consular officers and military personnel posted, all over the world. So, how do we do a better job of coordinating our efforts and coordinating our international and our domestic challenges in a way that will allow us to be as effective as possible when dealing with those kind of Canadian security concerns. Jonathan, maybe start with you.
You're full of easy questions today. So it's a great question. And going back to my original comment on economics and security and the fact that you can't tidily separate them, because states, and especially adversarial states, will use whatever tool they have to secure their national interests. And it's true with interfering in domestic affairs. And I think that we've seen this time and time again. We had two foreign interference inquiries. I think the one point I would say, Gord, is, and if you really read between the lines, you can get it, but we have to be more intellectually honest with ourselves about, number one, the magnitude and also the capacity of states to interfere and to pursue their interests at the cost of domestic security for Canadians. So to give you an example, I mean, you could read a report or an inquiry report sometimes, and you could see a lot of names listed. And of course, you could read a little bit closer and you could get a sense. And I think people who are in the business know which actors have the capacity and the magnitude of those threats are most consequential to Canadians and Canadian interests. But we're not necessarily that clear on that. And I think if we're not clear on that, sometimes the policy response can be a bit challenged. I'm going to cut the sort of diplomatic language on it. And in my view, China is the largest actor when it comes to foreign interference and foreign influence. But if we just use a suite of saying, well, we got Pakistan, we got India, I'm not downplaying other challenges, but I think the magnitude and capacity, I think head over heels for us would be the People's Republic of China. I think we need to own that, and have a lot of conversations premised on that. When it comes to what's the sort of policy response, I 100% agree with you on this, that, there is an awareness and an understanding on the agencies that are frontline that they need to resource more, whether it's linguistic capabilities, whether it's actually through the Indo-Pacific strategy in the case of China. I think that there's more capabilities being pushed out to the field. All of that's good, but I actually think we're going to have to reform, going back to partnerships, the way that we think about partnerships that could assist Canada and assist Canadian interests. And Five Eyes is great. I mean, it's, you know, we've done many important things and we have some challenges. Thankfully, I'm not on that panel, but we actually have to think beyond that. In this case, I'm speaking about the PRC. If we're talking about the PRC, we should be thinking about who knows the PRC and who knows about the tactics, that would interfere or influence, in our domestic affairs. And then I think we have to be looking at partners, not only Japan and South Korea, but I think we also need to be looking quietly at Taiwan, which I think we are. But of course, there's a lot of reasons that we don't want to say that publicly. So I think there's a lot of different constructs, not just how the bureaucracy works with each other, but which types of partners that we actually work with.
Tamar, why don't we go to you, and then we'll go to Stephanie to wrap up.
Sure. I'll go quickly on this one, on the issue of coordination. And I think one of the many angles that we can use to think about that is the role of the center in, and you would obviously know this very well, given some of the positions you've had, in terms of coordinating responses, not only on national security, on foreign policy, but on issues that really interconnect all of these issues, going back to tout et dans tout, showing that Jean Dion was right on that one as well. The debate that comes up every now and then is, should PCO play a stronger role in coordinating responses at the policy development level, but also on a day-to-day operational level? There's a lot of foreign affairs people here who may, I don't want to generalize, but not necessarily be sympathetic to the proposal that PCO should be stronger. But it is to me a weakness in the system that PCO has a limited ability to really cajole and coerce in a much stronger way the coordination of responses. I realize that it's easy to say and it's hard to do in practice. What does it actually mean that PCO, the SNI part, the FDP part, should play a stronger role? Does it mean more money and personnel, simply? Probably. Does it mean legislating the role of either the NSIA or the Foreign Defense Policy Advisor, whatever the precise detail is now? They are not the product of legislation, these positions, which is somewhat unique for deputy head equivalents. There are limits to how much that can be done given our Westminster system of government, right? There's always the issue of the accountability that other deputy heads have to their own structures. There was a mandate letter to the previous NSIA, which I thought was a reasonable step in that direction, but it's not clear to me if that precedent will be repeated. So all that to say, I think we need to have a bit of a debate as to whether PCO is equipped enough to do everything you described in your question. I would just finish my answer with a quote from somebody who I won't name because it was a Chatham House workshop, but somebody at a senior level who had worked in both PCO and in line departments and said in response to this direct question, should PCO be stronger? When I was at PCO, I wanted PCO to be stronger. And now that I am not in PCO in a line department, I want PCO to be weaker. And it's a funny line, and that person was very aware of why that's the problem, right? In many ways. So I think that should be part of the discussion.
Stephanie?
Thanks. I just didn't want PCO to duplicate. That was really the big issue, right? Sure, you can have different perspectives, but we don't want to have the same conversation over and over again. So I think that role in PCO was really important as a convener, as an ultimate arbitrator, maybe, is so they don't have authority over our line department budgets, and they can't tell my minister in other department X or Y what to do or say, but they can certainly interpret what the prime minister is going to say, and he or she generally wins anyway. So I'm going to give a really bureaucratic response. I would disagree. I think it's an illusion that the government of Canada is not actually joined up. We decide together what intelligence priorities are every year. We decide together what our focus is for country X or Y. You guys, as heads of mission, decided every year what it was you were all going to work together on, and that included the OGDs. You helped, or you should have, helped with their PMAs, so there was a direct influence in the outcome of those conversations. That fed back into headquarters. Certainly in my time in national defense, we really put a huge new emphasis on the role of the defense attaché, and it's going to change even more as the new ones get rolled out with new training. The big strategies that you've been referring to, Indo-Pacific strategy, for instance, and I'll go to defense industrial strategy after, but that IPS, like how long were we working on that and all of us together? And I think that the growing these new strategies from birth as a government means that there's buy-in, that there are eggs in every basket, and that we all have fingers in the pie and the need for a successful outcome, because it's each of us as departments who will fail. It's not just the whole, it's each of us individually as well. The defense industrial strategy is a good example of multiple departments being involved. And here, ultimately, the initial goal of the strategy was not to find money. It's not meant to be a budget ask. It was meant to be a framework strategy. It ended up having money attached to it, and boy, did it get popular when that happened, especially when there were cuts underway across government. So that also drove really clear governance, really clear outcomes, very specific objectives by each department. So as a whole, again, it has become a much stronger document because of that joint approach that is now underway. And then the last thing I would say is I think there's a whole lot more that goes on that is just not noticed. I mean, we all have separate in our old jobs, right? All have separate conversations with many, many, many countries every day. And they led to things, but they weren't necessarily public, and they weren't necessarily something that everybody in government needed to know about, but us and PCO and national defense and us, I'm the global affairs, us. But I would say Vietnam. I mean, you talked about Taiwan and, of course, South Korea. You've seen we're just signing now just signed, about to sign the GSOIA, so the sharing of information agreement, doing one with Germany, with France, that kind of stuff. Like regular Canadians, like what? But we know what that means. And that means where what you were getting at. We can share more information. We can do more things together.
Thanks. Tom, I was talking about PCO. I remember going through that whiplash on the way in and the way out. I remember on the way in, first day there, Susan Cartwright, who was just leaving, turned to me and said, you know, everybody should work in PCO once. So, yeah, the perspectives change pretty quickly. Where you stand depends on where you sit. Mr. Proudfoot hasn't jumped to his feet and brought out a big hook yet. So I think that means I have time to go to the floor and ask. Oh, boy, that happened fast. Okay. Okay. Well, see that lady standing there right at the back there?
Can I, just before we go to the first question, we started the day with 6 mics and now we have 5, which makes us a little short. So I'm not sure where it, oh, you're double mic'd.
Okay.
Awesome.
There you go. Should be. I didn't touch him.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Jutta Warg. I really thoroughly enjoyed the panel, and thank you to you guys who are supposed to be retired and putting your feet up, coming out to talk about these important issues. I'll change the conversation just a little bit. I am a person who recently retired also from the public service. I was at Global Affairs the last 10 or so years, but contrary to many of my colleagues, I took a mid-career break and worked on a PhD at University of Toronto, which incidentally was not at all appreciated when I came back. It's like, well, you got a PhD, big fucking deal. But one thing that I wanted to put on the horizon for you is we're talking about the integration of domestic and foreign, the need to work whole of government. I spent a lot of years working on the Arctic, and whole of government was very, very important in that context and still is. And we're looking at a policy horizon that is probably much farther out than policy thinkers have had to deal with, certainly in the last few decades. So the question that I want to pose to the panel is there a way for Canada to integrate a little bit more between what governments are doing, and that could be different levels of government, and what our thinkers in our universities are doing? I think, contrary to other countries, the connection between our various universities across Canada, not just the ones located here in Ottawa, they're growing talent. They have young people coming up. They're quite disconnected from the very important policy conversations that are going on. And I'm from Germany originally. I know how the think tanks work there and the universities with the governments, again, at various levels. It's not fully integrated, but it's a conversation that works very well. China, the government of China is relying very heavily on its academia, whether it's on technology issues, policy issues, et cetera. I don't think we want the Chinese model, but there is probably something to be said for a closer integration between our academia and government and civil society, of course, and partly because it has the co-benefit of bringing young people into the conversation to make them aware of the tricky challenges that government has to face with. And I just would like to hear your perspectives on that. Thank you.
So thanks for that question. I remember in the earliest days in the Foreign Service being struck by how difficult it was to find academic experts sometimes when you needed to draw them into particular subject matters. I remember at one point having to go and talk to the Jean Monnet chair at University of Montreal, I think it was, about your issues related to the European Union, and realizing that in order to actually get them to do anything, I would have to give them several thousand dollars because they simply weren't resourced to produce things in the way that you know we could make use of them. Rob McRae, who's another former ambassador to NATO, chaired a body at Carleton University a few years ago that looked at security and intelligence issues and tried to bring together the academic expertise that he had access to there with the work that was being done around the government to see if there could be a greater crosswalk between those two exercises. I went to one of those sessions. And what I remember was that he went down the side of the table with all the representatives from different departments. And he said, at this moment in time, what do you most need help with? What are the things that your various departments could really use assistance studying? And they went down the side of the table, and there was CSIS was there, and CSE was there, and D&D was there, and GAC was there. And we went all the way down the table. And it's just a reflection of where we were at that moment in time. But while there were some different issues that were dependent on the organization, there were some issues that came up repeatedly over and over again. And one of them at that moment was cyberspace. It was, we're all trying to cope with the challenges in our areas of jurisdiction with respect to cyberspace. And another one was outer space. And because there was huge national security things going on that reflected in outer space, and we were trying to draw the thing. And we went all the way down the table. And then Rob turned to all the academics on the other side of the table, and he said, okay, tell us what you're working on and how does it relate to this? And they went down the other side of the issue, the issues, and it said, well, we're really interested in Aboriginal issues and how they pertain to national security. And we're really interested on gender studies and how they pertain to national security. And by the time they got finished at the end, the Venn diagram had no overlap in it at all. We were talking about two completely different solitudes. So yeah, it's a big challenge, and it's not a new challenge, but there's somebody here who's like you, got experience on both sides of this challenge. Tama technically worked for me at one point in the government.
in the narrowest of technical sense, because I was on leave without pay. Yeah.
And then went on to academia, where he's been showing us how to do things ever since.
I have views on that. I spent 11 years at National Defense, right? And now it's been 12 years or almost 12 years here. To me, the government academia relations in this country don't work well. And that situation you described, describes it well. And I think the blame goes on both sides in some ways. I think on the academic side, much of what happens is of limited, if not of no use, to people in government. That's just how it is. Not relevant, very theoretical, very critically minded, which can have its own value, may or may not have its own value in other circumstances, but from a policy relevance perspective, does not or has very little. It's simply not the incentive structure in academia. It's simply not in the culture. But I would also say that to simply blame academics is not inaccurate, but is only part of the story. I think on the government side, and certainly in this government, in this town, I mean, not this current political government, the insularity of the culture, the lack of a tradition to consult outside expertise, is also matters. And by outside expertise, I would include academia, but other forms of outside expertise as well, which can equally matter in some circumstances. The next question then is, well, what to do about that? Is it worth trying to do something about that? In theory, yes, but with everybody being very busy, is it realistic to think about trying to do something about that? Sort of, but it's not obvious. More interchanges, you mentioned one. There's not a lot of them, so they don't work well, but maybe there's a critical mass aspect that would allow it to work better. More government transparency. would also help to provide more information to outside experts on what is going on, which would allow those that are doing something useful to better understand and connect. Because if you don't know what's going on inside the black box, then it's very difficult to connect with it as well. I could go on for a long time, but I think that the diagnosis is a fairly critical one.
Stephanie? Oh, Jonathan.
Okay, let me just, I agree with everything you said, Tamal. Let me just kind of give a few lines from a sort of think tank perspective. So, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work in or with think tanks in a few different countries. Fortunate not to have worked with the one in China, which basically are utilized for state intelligence and security services. So that's not a model we'd like to use. But there are things I think that we can pick up from other partners. So the U.S. is a bizarre, weird model as far as how their think tank operates with government. So that's also potentially not the best example. But I think that there are good examples, for example, in Japan, where I worked several years, and also in Europe. I think the challenge, and I like the way that, Tamai, you mentioned this, is consulting outside expertise. So the thing that I've found difficult is it's almost like a box-ticking exercise, like we've got a strategy coming, talk to an academic. Where are the academics? We should talk to them. At least we should say we talked to them. And both sides, I think, don't see the value in that. I think the challenge is, if you're thinking about curating like a dinner table of expertise, is who should be at that dinner table? And academics, certain ones should be, but private sector, absolutely. Actually, yourselves, like former officials, I think, are not leveraged and utilized as much as well. And I thought this ahead of the Indo-Pacific strategy. I remember when the advisory committee, and apologies to anyone who was on the advisory committee, but there were very few former officials. Like, I would expect former ambassadors or heads of missions, more of yourselves in that sort of concept. So I think it's, think about that policy dinner table, who should be at that, academics for sure, but a broader sense of outside expertise and a broader sense of interchange too. Like, yes, academics, but let's think of engaging the private sector, and not just having your government private sector silo over here, your government academic sector over here, and then those scary think tank people, they just criticize us. We don't want to engage with them. I think you need to bring all the mad guests together and hope for the best.
Funny, that's what we do abroad, right? That's exactly what we used to do, and have really interesting dinner parties, in fact. And when officials from Ottawa travel, that's who we get for them to meet, to have a really good conversation. When I was in Berlin, I met with think tanks in Berlin, because you do. Here, when we do focus groups or policy development, and I'm now thinking more agriculture on the food security policy, for instance, they would go out, yes, to some academics, but really to the practitioners. So less theory and more practical. Maybe to your point about if it's academics, it's not that it's unrealistic, but it's maybe less operational, yeah, applicable. So maybe that's partly why. And so the issue around, well, what are you studying and how is that going to be useful? I don't need more theory. I need to know, what am I going to do with this piece of information, or how do I make it work? The last thing I would say is, unfortunately, it is a pocket of money, an envelope of money in any government department that's probably the easiest to cut.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I'm sure, Michael, you had to do this a few times, pretty much everybody who went. Remember, we used to have a culture branch in global affairs, which where we defate them, whatever it was. But that stuff, like the minute there's a drop or a budget cut, is whoop, those guys go. And yet. Critical for all of us. So keep up the good fight.
Or can I just add one last very quick point too, is that taking advantage of the networks too, especially in the private sector. So I just got back last week from Kazakhstan. As one does, the CEO of Cameco probably has better connections than almost anybody in government. So same case for other countries like India, for example. There we have some private sector individuals who have immense networks. And actually, as much as people may not want to think about it, sometimes we have academics and even think tankers that have pretty significant networks that can be helpful. So I think it's not just thinking of the advice perspective, but actually utilizing a Team Canada approach and, you know, not poaching those networks, but trying to find a way to integrate yourself into those networks, I think is an important piece of advice.
I'm just wondering, given the shortness of time left, we have three people who want to ask questions. Maybe we could get all the questions.
Great idea.
And see where we go. So, Sabine.
Hi, Sabine Nerga, former ambassador, not Eminence Beige, as my former boss would call us. One comment on this last discussion. I have two words for you, Wilton Park. I mean, the Brits pay for this think tank, basically. And whenever they have a policy question they want to kick around, they have one of their events and people scramble to get in there and give them that advice. So that is something we should maybe spend a couple of hundred grand on. I had two questions, but I'll limit it to one. Reality and illusion. What's the illusion of the United States still being a stable partner on defense and security issues? And what's the reality and how we have to deal with that and factor that into decision making?
Second one?
That's the one question that I have.
Second questioner?
Thank you. Okay. Joanna Keating, you'll tell from my accent, I'm from Scotland, newly arrived representative Scottish head of Scottish Government Office in Canada, based in the British High Commission. So my interest, I'm really interested in this former questioner touched on this, the Arctic, and really just Canada's plans around Arctic alliances with recent issues around Greenland, etc. So just what's the future for Canada in the sort of setting of the Arctic alliances? Thank you.
And back to you, Gord. We went to down to two questions.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, but we have one online.
Yeah. Oh.
No, never mind.
Well, that was fast. Okay, Tamad, do you want to take...
I'll take the U.S. question. I'll be very, very brief because I think we could easily spend the rest of the day on that. I think the reality, and I think there's a lot of illusions in discourse right now about the U.S. and about the choices. You were talking about options that we face. I think the reality is that we have no choice but to manage our relationship with the U.S. There is no world ahead of us where the U.S. is not 1, 5, 10, 20 years from now, by far our number one partner on the trade, defense, security, and intelligence side. Diversification, and we can be frustrated about it, and we are, and we will be. There is no world, that's the reality, in which things go back to where they were before. A Democrat gets elected in 2028, he or she will not remove tariffs on at least some of them. But there is no world in which we can succeed in diversifying significantly away from the U.S. The best we can do is chip away and reduce our dependence, become a bit more resilient, a bit more sovereign or autonomous, whatever word you want to use, which allows us to be a bit more resilient to the bullying by the U.S. to which we are exposed and to which we will continue to be exposed. So I think the reality is that we have to manage that new reality. But the idea that we can really diversify away from the U.S. is an illusion.
Stanley, Jonathan?
I can take that. I like the Wilton Park idea. That's a great idea. As a good maritimer, maybe I'll say like Mahone Bay or something, like try to stimulate Nova Scotia. But I like that idea. Quickly in the U.S., I mean, I agree with you, the reality, Toma. I would say, too, we have to resist this inevitable fatalism, which, I mean, the Davos speech, I think, sort of gave this sense of fatalism as well, that there's a, even though it didn't necessarily mention the United States, that there's this trajectory that cannot be stopped. And then, again, maybe post-COVID, all of our brains just go to the worst possible scenario. I think the reality is we just don't know. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty there. I don't think optimism and being overly optimistic is a good policy formula as well. But I think there's probably 50 different alternative futures that are in between the worst fatalist future that I think many of us are thinking about. And I think we have to prepare for those futures with the United States and realize, number one, one of the challenges with this roadshow and the different dance partners, whether it's in Europe or Asia or elsewhere, is that they all have different strategic relationships to the United States. We are right in the belly next to the United States. So it can be tempting, you know, to fly to Berlin or to fly to Helsinki or Seoul or wherever and say, you know, we're all U.S. partners and allies. We all share the same fate. We don't. That's just a reality. It doesn't mean that we can't have agency, we can't be autonomous in certain ways, but we have different strategic choices than Berlin or Paris. And that's the reality. And I think that's just something maybe uncomfortable. There's good parts of it, there's bad parts of it, but that's where we're at.
Go ahead.
I think safe to say it ties into the Arctic conversation. Completely agree with Thomas and Jonathan that our relationship with the U.S. is not going away. And maybe just reiterate, from a military perspective, remains strong. Officials' working level remains strong. Intelligence continues to work as it should. I think it's safe to say there are a lot of very pragmatic folks who are our counterparts in the U.S. And it's not a question of we have to get through this. It's how do we leverage the opportunities that we have right now to come out stronger at the end? From a Canadian perspective and in terms of defense investment, you will have seen there are huge amounts going, and I hesitate to say to the north, but in the defense of the north. It doesn't physically necessarily mean it's going to be in the north. I mean, obviously, if we're repairing a runway in the far north, that's where that money goes. But for instance, the funding that is going to Arctic Over the Horizon radar is not going to northern communities. The actual structures are going to be built in Ontario. So there's also a difference between how we operationalize the policy changes that have to be made and the program implementation that has to be made that will end up in a much stronger Canada, and at the same time demonstrating to the U.S. that we are a strong, reliable partner. Similar conversation underway on energy, for that matter. Do you want a reliable source of clean energy? This is where it's coming from. There's a little bit that gets tricky there, though, in the how attractive do you want to be? You want to be a really strong partner that is worth having as a partner and not as the 51st state, for instance. Yeah. Arctic alliances, with the advent of the new arrivals into NATO, I'm going to get my math wrong, 7 of the 8 Arctic countries are now allied members. This is huge. This means a big shift in how NATO talks about capabilities and the requirements that Canada needs to produce every year to defend allied territory. And this, I think, we're going to see a lot of progress on over the coming years, thanks to the foreign and defense policy work being done in global affairs and in national defense, and I think with academia as well. It's going to make a big difference. And that strengthening of the role will also benefit our relationship with the U.S. Anything that demonstrates that we're lifting our burden, we're carrying our share, will make a difference.
I think I got time for one more question over there.
We have three questions that go back to the discussion about relations with academia. I'm not sure you're going to be able to answer, but I want to give the questioners a chance to be heard. So from Phil Calvert, he refers to Asia branch that has set up a China research unit, bringing in academic experts. I don't know if it continues or if it survived. Would you have any comments on such a model? From Anne Smiley, she said, the Monk School prepared the paper Sovereign by Design, Strategic Options for Canadian AI Sovereignty. I understand this was sent to several ministries and was well received, as there would not have been the capacity to produce this within the government. How can this be a more frequent occurrence to utilize our academic resources? And there was more of a comment by Tamia Spitka to the effect that she agreed that academic capacity and knowledge is not used as much as it could. So I don't know if that is something you can answer, but as I say, I wanted to make sure they were heard.
Anybody want to weigh in? Okay, I think we will have to take those all under advisement. We'll give those some thought, maybe creating questions for next year's session. I'm going to wrap this up now. I want to thank all three of you for your wonderful contributions. I think I said at the outset that we had a really big sandbox in which to play, and you did a great job of helping illustrate that point. We could do the entire day on just issues related to national security, but there are other aspects of foreign policy and illusions and realities that need to be teased out a little bit. So we will cede the floor here to the next session, and thank you all very much.